Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, today. And our guest today is award-winning author Shelley Fraser Mickle, author of Itching to Love, The Story of a Dog. Now, Shelley grew up in the Mississippi River Delta, attended the University of Mississippi, hoping to learn about writing from William Faulkner, who lived next to the campus. After college, she worked in mental health because she wanted to learn how to create compelling characters in novels she would one day write, as well as to learn to help people live their best life, and especially to diagnose everyone in her family. I think Shelley, she's a novelist. She's published two novels?
About a dozen novels,
okay. And adult nonfiction books and children's books. And Itching to Love is a humorous memoir. But she is maybe best known as the storyteller on NPR's Morning Edition. So welcome to Writer's Voices, Shelley.
Thank you.
All right. So, you know, one of the questions that I often ask is, did you always want to be a writer? But that is answered very clearly in this book.
Oh, yes. Yes, I had to write about that.
Yeah.
You know, my grandmother's husband died in the 1918 flu epidemic. And she used to come to our house and for long visits to dull her loneliness. So it was her job to make me take a nap until she fell asleep. She would read to me. And my nickname was the Screaming Mimi. And I recently learned that's the name of a World War II bomb. So I must have been pretty much of a handful. So my grandmother would read to me, and I think that she decided I might be the first woman in the family to go to prison. So she started taking me to Sunday school every time the church doors opened. But there in church, I only learned stories that were older than my grandmother. And at the age of 5, I decided there must be something in stories that we need to have lasted that long. So I decided that stories were like air or water or a good purse. I decided then I wanted to be a storyteller, a writer. And on top of that, I fell in love with words, the sound of them. And apparently I have some genes in my background. My grandfather was the editor of the newspaper and always dressed like Mark Twain. So I think I was just naturally brought to that. But I've been obsessed since the age of 5 of being a writer, and I've never deviated. Nothing has ever been able to kill that passion. So building on that, when it was time to go to college, I had heard that William Faulkner won the Nobel Prize for Literature. So I decided, well, gosh, he must know something about writing. So I'm going to go where he is. So I went to the University of Mississippi.
And where were you living at that? Where were you living at that time?
In Memphis, Tennessee.
Okay.
Which is only like 60 miles away from Ole Miss.
Oh, okay.
And so I wrote William Faulkner a letter, and I told him I was coming. You know, in those little towns, the postmaster knows everyone, so I'm sure he got it. I just addressed it. William Faulkner, Oxford, Mississippi. Well, shortly before I went to the college, he died. And I took it personally. I thought, gosh, he's gone to great lengths to avoid me. But anyway, I stayed there. And then I know you're interested in writers' careers. I had a wonderful thing happen to me. I was working for years on a novel, and I had about 600 pages, and I was raising... It kept spooling out like knitting a sweater, right? And I had published a lot of little short stories in literary journals and whatnot. So I was putting all those together into a novel. And then I wasn't having any luck finding a publisher, but a friend of mine handed the book to Lewis Rubin, all 600 pages. I didn't know who Lewis Rubin was, and I never defend my work. So he wrote me a letter, and he said, I've been reading this 600-page tome, and some of it is the most god-awful stuff I've ever read. And then he said, but then I come a few pages later to something that I start laughing at, and I can't stop. So here's a check for $300. If you will work with me, we'll see if we come up with something publishable. Well, I didn't know who he was until I opened the New York Times and read an article about him. And he was the greatest living editor since Maxwell Perkins.
Oh, for heaven's sakes. And for those who might not be familiar, Maxwell Perkins was Fitzgerald's editor, right?
And Lewis Rubin was renowned as a literary scholar, and he was a great fan of Mark Twain. And he worked with me long enough to where he said, after 3 years, and we published the book, and because of his reputation, it became a New York Times notable book that year of 1989. But he told me, he said, your greatest talent is being funny and being able to write funny things. And you need to know that. So I've gone on and written a whole lot of other different things. But recently, I've been so disturbed about our mental health coming out of the pandemic, and also the dissension between the political parties, which is not supposed to be there. They're just supposed to represent different views of government. But I've been so distressed about that, I reached back in and realized that I had read about this dog on NPR. Here in Florida, we have enough undeveloped land that dogs can spoon in the woods unchaperoned. So we call them Florida brown dogs because they have everything in them, every breed you can imagine. And this dog that I'm going to tell you about and wrote about, he weighed about 120 pounds. He was brown, and he had a head as big as a gallon pickle jar.
Oh, my gosh.
And he had snake yellow eyes, had mostly bulldog in him. And on his feet, he had little dots like a bird dog had gotten in the gene pool. So it was clear he came from a long line of loose women. Anyway, I found this 3-minute piece that I had read as a script on NPR. That's what you do on NPR. You have a script, and then they teach you how to deliver it as if you weren't reading it. But if you didn't read it, you'd have a lot of uhs, and it would not be polished enough. So anyway, I found that little piece, and I was still so disturbed about how we were handling things coming out of the pandemic and the political situation. I read it and I said, you know, this is pretty funny. Maybe I ought to expand it. Before I knew it, I had 100 pages of my memoir. I got my whole life into 100 pages in the PDF. And so
I think maybe you left a bit out.
Yeah, of details. It moves fast.
Yes.
Because we don't have much patience today. So anyway, I certainly don't have much patience. Anyway, I found this wonderful publisher who wanted to bring it out quickly because that's important to me. I've written 2 big narrative histories and published them in the last 4 years. So I wanted this to come out quickly. I always say in a video, I had to wait for everyone in my family to die before I wrote my memoir.
I understand that.
And then I had to live long enough to write the last page. So I just turned 81.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. But this is my whole life in this lovely little book that they beautifully produced and illustrated. And it's my gift to all readers. It's dedicated to all the mothers in the world. Because really what this is about is empty nest syndrome. So when my children grew up and moved away, and were no longer the center of my life, I had to fill that nest with something. So this is kind of the fun part. I'm married to a pediatric brain surgeon. He was not home very much. And when he was so tired, I could boss him around. So I built a farm. I built a farm and I had two horses at the time, Skip and Robert Redford. And you can guess which one was the Palomino. So I was in the barn one day, tacking up my horse to ride because I decided I was going to revive that childhood dream of being a cowgirl. And this dog, my neighbor's dog across the street, when the neighbor would go to work, he would dig out from under the fence and spend time around my farm. So this one day, he ran in the barn and grabbed my horse's galloping boot, which is something you put on for protection when you're getting ready to ride them. So that galloping boot cost me like $70. So I was outraged and I chased him home. And his owner always kept up the garage door like a foot for Buddy to get out of rain or whatever. So I pushed it up and there sat Buddy in the corner of the garage with a galloping boot in his mouth. And I told him to spit it out. He did, reluctantly, but he did spit it out. He could speak about five languages. So anyway, I then saw next to his feed bowl a whole lot of my things that he had stolen and hoarded. He had my shirt that I'd left in the barn. He had a towel that I'd wiped my sweat on, my comb, a water bottle. Now, this sounds funny, but you'll get it. As old as I am, I've had a lot of weird boyfriends, but I never had the obsessive adoration that Buddy was offering. Oh. So soon after that, my neighbor called and he had recently been divorced or a year before gotten divorced. And he said, I'm getting married again. And my new wife has a dog that Buddy instantly beat up. So will you take Buddy? He seems to have a thing for you. So that's the beginning of this story about the decade I spent with this dog. And the first thing I had to answer was, what did he see in me that I did not see in myself?
Why he adored you so much?
Yeah. Yeah. And the book is actually a journey through philosophies. And the first one I went to, I wanted to study cross-species relationships. And, you know, we know, whether or not we know, all relationships change us. And this one with Buddy certainly changed me. And you can read it. I can tell you the end of the book. I used to say, if I tell you the end in Godfather talk, I'd have to kill you. But then I've decided that, you know, the journey of how I got to the epiphany is really what's fun.
Right.
So I'm going to go ahead and tell you.
Okay.
This is so fast.
Okay.
I eventually got to studying the recent science since the year 2000 about canine brains. There's a neuroscientist at Emory who actually trained his dog to get in an MRI machine so they can see when their brains light up and different things to learn more about them. So anyway, what I learned through science is that dogs' eyes are different from ours. They have fewer photoreceptors in their retina, and their eyes also let in more light. And that's why they can hunt at night and see at night, and also why their eyes are glowing when we take photographs of them. Isn't that fascinating to know? So anyway, I learned that they can't see very clearly close up, so they tend to step back and gaze at our faces. And as they do, they read our emotions. So in a sense, they are the most emotionally intelligent creatures on earth. And Buddy, when you get the book, this is the fun part. I found three photographs of him from that decade I spent with him. And in every one, he's staring at my face, just obsessively. And I realized in my epiphany of writing this book that he knew I was missing my children. And being a bulldog, he was hardwired to take care of someone. He needed someone to be the center of his life, and I wanted to be the center of someone else's life. Wow. So we were a perfect match.
So how did your kids feel about being replaced by a dog?
Well, I think they've always kind of known. I love all animals, but anyway, they've gotten used to it by now. But it's
and one of your trademarks in your relationship with animals is kissing them on the head with bright red lipstick.
Yeah, Buddy always followed his owner home after he'd given him to me because his food bowl was there. So I realized, you know, there was not going to be a bill of sale. There was not going to be any way. We were bonded by the heart. But I wanted Buddy to know he was mine forever. So I've decided, and it's true, I've given several keynote addresses, and I follow really prominent people in our community, and it makes me nervous. Like, I followed our female sheriff one year. I said, you know, this is not fair, because when she gave her speech, she was wearing a gun. So I always said, you know, my claim to fame is I'm really a good kisser. But I don't know that for real, because you'd have to interview the people I kiss. And I'm afraid to know the truth. So with Buddy, I said, you know, the most fun thing in life is to go to the grocery store and choose lipstick shades and take them home and brand the people you love with them. So I make up all these funny names for lipstick shades, like Commie Red, Full Bank Account Wine. So I chose one for Buddy called Crazy in Love Ruby.
Aww.
And I kissed him on the head, that big, huge head, and said, you're now Buddy Mickle forever.
Did he eventually stopped going back to his previous home?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I took him in that first night when I had been given him. And he found a place beside my bed to sleep every night. He was a huge dog, you know, very heavy and intimidating looking. In the book, I said he was always a victim of profiling.
Do you feel like dogs, you know, like being so emotionally intelligent, that they can tell a good person from somebody with bad intent? Because one thing that I have not had a dog in about 25 years. I had dogs from early. We always had a dog in the family when I was a child and growing up. And then I became a mother very young, and we always had dogs until I moved into, we lived out in the country. And then when I moved into town and was single and was traveling a lot, it wasn't feasible to have a dog anymore. So, but whenever I'm out around, first of all, my kids' dogs, everybody else's dogs always love me. You know, they always come right to me, want my attention. But even when I'm just walking out in the neighborhood, it seems like every dog that I walk by wants my attention, wants me to pet them. And I don't know if they do that with everybody, or if it's just that they know I really love dogs.
Well, you must be glowing, your heart glowing, because they can see your heart instantly.
Aww.
And they can tell so much about people. I can't live without a dog. So writing this book was so much fun for me. And I thread through there a lot about my writing career.
Yes.
Because I've taught workshops in writing humor. And it's fascinating to know the tricks. Like, not many people know, and I like to share this and should do it more often, that a laugh is considered a reflex, like a sneeze, a cough, or an eye blink. And those reflexes always protect us from something trying to get into our bodies that would be harmful. That's why we sneeze and cough and blink our eyes. And so a laugh is considered a reflex, and you can't predict when it comes out. It's like a cough. You just laugh, and something happens in your brain that sets off this little explosion of illumination, and you respond by laughing. And then I've done a great dive into Norman Cousins' study of what the laughter does for the body. And I would like to actually write or speak more about that because it's so fascinating. He was a journalist, and he had written a big book called The Anatomy of an Illness, in which he overcame, I think it was heart disease, by studying humor and making sure he had an optimistic outlook. So Joan Kroc gave him a lot of money to quantify the effects of laughter on the body. The study, you know, physicians go to medical school to learn to treat disease, but no one studies how the body can repair itself. Mm. And so that's what's important to know. When we laugh, the brain can release some 30 secretions that affect our mood and our ability to for resilience. For instance, they can release endocrines and enkephalins, which are peptides to signal to the body to release analgesic secretions to dull pain. And they found one of the first things that Norman Cousins found studying at the University of California Medical School was that the wards of wounded soldiers after World War II, they had a laugh cart. And then it was, I would like to think that my book would be in there today. But they had a lot of Mark Twain and Woody Allen and the different humorists that were renowned. And when those soldiers read pieces from those books, they required less pain medication. Now, isn't that wonderful to know?
Yes. Yes, it is.
So I'm really big into this. And the other part of this, I don't think I've told you this today yet. It's almost a warning. I was raised by a mother who thought every day she was on an episode of I Love Lucy.
So your mother was funny.
Oh, definitely. And she insisted that everybody around her give her a story. It wasn't the bread she needed when she sent me to the grocery store. I had to come home with a funny story. And it was because she suffered from depression her whole life. Mm. And comedy and funny stories were her elixir. So I learned to do that. And I find today, I just naturally go to the funny story that's happening around me and bring it home and share it with someone during the day. Like, for instance, this little one. A couple of years ago, I gave a talk to the Friends of the Library about this very thing, funny stories, and how we in the South especially look for those. And this woman came up afterward, and she said, my mother lives in Alabama, and she just turned 100 years old. So yesterday, she went to the doctor for her checkup. And I was eager to call her up today and see how it went. So I called her up and said, how did the visit to the doctor go? And her mother said, oh, it was perfectly awful. It was horrendous. He looked terrible. But that's an example of a laugh coming from what's unexpected.
Yes.
It's that last two parts of our brain, something comes together in an unexpected way, and there's a little bit of an explosion in our brains that comes out as a laugh. Isn't that fun?
It is. And, you know, I do tend to laugh more than most people. And I know I've had friends who were like actors in a play or something, and they'd say they really liked it when I came to their play because they could hear my laugh. Apparently, I also have a very distinctive laugh. Some years ago, I was in a video store, and I go up to the counter, and this young woman says, you're Monica Hadley, right? And I go, yeah, she goes, I was a friend of your daughter's, moved away when I was like 8 or 10 years old. And this, you know, would have been 20 some years later. I recognized your laugh.
Oh, how fun. That's the greatest compliment I think you can have.
I know.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your interview because you are fun.
Oh, well, thank
it's
you.
It's kind of hard to talk about this book when somebody doesn't get the jokes.
Yeah, well, that is true. That is true. I used to cry easily, too, but as I've gotten older, I laugh more easily than I cry. Which I think that's a good sign. So
it's a very good sign.
I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest is Shelley Fraser-Mickle, author of Itching to Love, The Story of a Dog. So there's so many things that you've mentioned that I want to come back to. First of all, you decided that stories were like air or water or a good purse. What's your favorite purse?
I have so many, I can't name one. It would be unfair.
Okay, well, what makes something a good purse?
Oh, the color, the way you hold it or wear it, and its compartments.
Ah, yes, the compartments. That is
mm-hmm.
crucial, isn't it? The other thing for me is the purse itself can't weigh too much.
Oh, true. Yeah, that's becoming more important as I've gotten older.
Yeah. Because if you start out with a purse that weighs 5 pounds, you're going to be pretty weighted down by the end of the day.
Right. But there's something about women in purses, and I've always had it. When I turned 6, this is kind of a funny little story. We moved to Hot Springs, Arkansas. My father was a civil engineer, and he was building a dam there. And so I like to go through the neighborhood and say, we moved here because of some damn business. And of course, I would get my mouth washed out with soap. But I think that I was such a pistol that my father actually paid for me to go to a private kindergarten. Because we didn't have kindergarten then in my day. You know, you started cold turkey. And you grew up like being trained like a puppy. Sit down, be quiet, and you're ready to go to school. But anyway, when I turned 6, they had a birthday party in that little kindergarten for me. And I pulled everyone aside and told them I wanted a purse for my birthday. And my mother was afraid I wouldn't get one, so she bought 2. And then she had a woman that did housework for us, and she bought me one, and my father bought me one, and my brother bought me one, and everyone in the kindergarten bought me one. I think I got 19 purses that day.
Oh my.
And my mother was afraid after I opened the first one and then the second one, they were all purses. She thought I'd be disappointed. I was in hog heaven. I loved it.
Wow. So how many purses do you have now?
Probably 19. I keep a running account.
Do you still have any of those from kindergarten?
No. No, I've trimmed down since then. But anyway, it's important for people to understand to make each other happy with a little story and collect them and go through the day and realize how lucky we are to be alive. I recently wrote, the last book I wrote was a narrative history about Alice Roosevelt. So I got waylaid by studying T.R. Roosevelt so much because he's one of our greatest presidents. And he lived life as if he were taking a bite out of life and letting it dribble down his chin. And I think that's what all of us should do.
When you're collecting stories, one of the things that that I have found helpful in life is when something not so fun happens, you know, something that you could be irritated by or frustrated by, just remember it's going to make a great story.
Oh, yeah. That's true. But it's important to collect those and share them. Very important. So...
Now, you talked about Mark Twain, and Mark Twain has always been one of my favorite people from history, you know, and he was sort of an important figure in my family lore because my mother's maiden name was Clements with a T on the end.
Oh, yeah.
But it was very similar to Clemens. And apparently one of my ancestors had written to Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain, to ask if maybe we were related. And I think he got a letter back from him saying, oh, it could be, you know, it's possible. So that was like a claim to fame that I would go around telling people as a kid that I was related to Mark Twain, even though there was no real evidence of it. But yeah, one of my favorite things. Yeah, really. One of my favorite things that he said or wrote is kind of applicable to your when you're talking about the first book you wrote that started out at 600 pages. And in Mark Twain wrote somebody, I don't know who it was, a letter, and he said, you know, dear so and so, I would have written a shorter letter, but I didn't have time.
That's just like him.
Yeah. And, you know, it is harder to make things concise. It takes more time to write concisely than to just go on and on and on. So I have a question. When you started working with Lewis Rubin, is that
Rubin?
And
Lewis Rubin,
on that first book, and at some point you realized how fortunate you were to have him engage with your work, which is just like astounding, really.
But
I do have some questions about that process. First of all, when you were writing that novel, were you intending to be funny?
I can't help it.
Okay. So you because a comedic novel is one of the hardest things to do well.
Yeah, and people don't realize it. I wrote a second novel that a reviewer said was the funniest story since Auntie Mame. And it was turned into a movie for CBS and had some great actors in it, and it did okay. But the reviewers, they didn't say anything bad about it, but it was not taken seriously. And that's always bothered me because writing comedy is hard.
Yeah,
it's easy to fall flat. And so I think basically what my mother gave me in being funny herself, I inherited it. She embarrassed me a lot.
I think I embarrassed my kids a lot, too.
That's our privilege. Yeah. Right? So, but anyway, my mother really was funny, and I can't help but see the funny in everything, you know, which is good and bad sometimes, because my daughter is a teenager. I would be laughing at some of her problems, and she said, "This is damn serious. Listen to me, you know." Everything in adolescence is a tragedy.
Oh, I know. Yeah. And if you could just, if you just knew at the time how unimportant those things will seem later. But there's no way to convey that to a young person, and no way for them to really understand that.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think now at my advanced age, I realize that life is so short. You have to embrace your anxiety, anxiety disorder, depression. Don't medicate it. Enjoy it. Embrace it.
Well, some people need medication.
Sure. Yeah. Get a little help with that. But
yeah.
Anyway, we need to encourage each other to be tough and optimistic and kind to each other, mainly kind.
Shelley,
so that's kind of,
would you like to read a little bit from the book?
Sure, and I'm going to set it up because it's a little bit complicated. I've told you that I built this farm where I am today in this lovely library. I've moved every book I've owned all over and finally got one room that it can all go into.
Are you ever willing to let go of books? Do you ever give them away or get rid of them?
Very hard.
My dad moved, when we moved from Pennsylvania to Iowa when I was like almost 14, he ended up having to take two moving trucks because he couldn't fit everything in one. And part of it was these boxes and boxes of books that ended up in the attic and never got opened again in Iowa. But he couldn't let go of them. He had to keep those books.
He just kept moving them around.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh, that's a great story. That's one thing about this book. It would be a dream of mine for people to take this book and read aloud at the dinner table, especially on holidays, when the conversation can become contentious, and read aloud these short little chapters. And then my story encourages people to tell their own stories about their dogs or a similar experience. And it's just a fun thing to do. So I'm going to set this up by telling you that I had this dream of riding in a world championship show at one point. And so I bought a little mare and I went with a trainer. We went to Oklahoma. I flew and he drove the horse out there to Oklahoma. And in the class I was riding in, she went into heat. And she was a whole lot more than I could handle. And everybody was riding great circles far away from us. And I suddenly realized a menopausal woman on a mare in heat, pretty soon everyone was going to ask us to leave. So my dream that I'd worked so hard to be able to bring about failed. So this chapter that I'm going to read to you is about my plane ride home. So, of course, I was down in the dumps. I would have to leave and fly home with nothing but a bruised ego to show for my time there. My husband had already flown back to take care of his patients, so I was by myself on the airplane heading back from Oklahoma, sitting beside a 7-year-old boy and his mother. As I stole glances of his perfect self with arms, face, short legs, and blue jeans while listening to the flute-like sound of his voice, it made me think of the day my son was dropped off from a carpool. I was writing in my studio upstairs in the house we lived in before building our home on Blueberry Hill Farm. My son got out of the car and came into the house, then panicked. He didn't think of looking for me upstairs and instead ran, trying to chase the carpool car down the long driveway, yelling, "She's not here. I can't find her. Help. Don't leave." Trotting toward him, I called, "I'm here. I was just upstairs. I'm here." The look on his face was the classic definition of relief and love. That moment stayed with me all these years as a perfect, sweet memory, only the meaning of motherhood as clearly as it can ever be felt. It was matched by the memory of my daughter on the day when I volunteered to be a field trip chaperone. As we walked through the zoo, I overheard a classmate say to my daughter, "Your mama walks funny." My daughter shot back, "Don't talk about my mama." She said it as well as a 300-pound football player talking trash before a game, "Yo, mama." Those are universal fighting words, and I'll never forget hearing my daughter's 7-year-old voice trash talking before she even knew what trash talking was, protecting me the best way she could. Now, there on that plane, flying back from the botched horse show in Oklahoma, I experienced one of my most life-affirming moments. Just as we were coming in for a landing, the heavens opened up with one of those gully whopper thunderstorms. Here in Florida, we call them frog stranglers. You know the kind. So much lightning, rain, and thunder that I began to wonder if my affairs were in enough order to keep my relatives from squabbling over the piddling stuff I'd leave. We bounced around for a while, like one of those carnival rides I never had enough guts to buy a ticket for. Then the pilot came on over the loudspeaker and said in his smoothest chewing gum voice that it was way too rough for him to try to set us down here, so he was just going to head over to Jacksonville and set us down there. A low moan of complaint moved throughout the coach section. Not only did we now face another 30-minute plane ride, but our relatives or friends who had come to meet us were now standing there, down there on the ground being told we were a no-show. The plan was that a bus was being sent to pick us up at the other airport, and then we'd have to ride it all the way back. The boy beside me in his jeans, boots, and plaid shirt had a cowlick over his forehead like a hand of cards. His mother wore shorts and a ruffled blouse. They reminded me of people I had grown up with in the Arkansas cotton belt. More than likely, their lives moved to the rhythm of weather and crops or night shifts and overtime. When I asked them who would be waiting for them, I learned that the boy's father had driven 50 miles to be at the airport. Our delay was a real bummer, we agreed. The mother was a good bit distressed. It was then that I witnessed the most amazing exchange. While the rest of us ducked back into our magazines or went on grumbling about our inconvenience, the boy began telling his mother stories. I don't know what they were about or where he got them, but looking at his mother's face, you would have thought he was telling her the most wonderful and hilarious tales she'd ever heard. She was laughing and watching him as if his every third sentence held the most delicious surprise. More than once, she reached over and punched him on the arm and cried out, "Stop, stop, I can't take it anymore," as if she were being tickled to death. The more she teasingly punched him, the more he talked on. Throughout our whole ride, even after we were taxiing down the runway into our detoured airport, the boy and his mother continued their exchange. When I got up to get my bag out of the overhead compartment, I glanced down at them. The boy's mother was still listening. I could see that without a doubt, the most wondrous light had been lit in that boy's face. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure it's still there. In fact, I'm pretty convinced that if anything lasts at all, it is this kind of light that is eternal. And it was a privilege to have been there when it was given. There you go.
And that was Shelley Fraser Mickle reading from Itching to Love, The Story of a Dog. So as you mentioned, this is much more than the story of a dog, and you keep coming back to the dog within the book. But you said it's also sort of a story of different philosophies,
right?
And one of the things that you talked about was the astronauts. So what's that got to do with this story?
I know. Well, when I wanted to answer what did Buddy see in me that I did not see in myself, I started researching relationships across differences because I wanted to bridge the difference of our species. And so I came upon this book written by Frank White, who calls himself a space philosopher. And he has interviewed astronauts that have gone into space for many years. And most of them say they went up into space as one person and came back as someone else. They were changed from the inside out. And I'm always fascinated by change from the inside out. Because if you live your life, you're going to be changed one way or another. So they all said that when they saw Earth from space, they saw it as the big blue marble. Mm-hmm. There were no fences, no borders. We are all one. And they likened it to Earthlings hanging on to the spaceship Earth. And we should reach out for each other. And of course, that's what Buddy and I did. And the next thing I did was study shape-shifting, which Native Americans practiced when they hunted the buffalo. They began to imagine being that buffalo and exchanging the need for food and survival and the gift of sacrifice. It's a spiritual and religious metaphor of what we believe in a religion as one dying for another. So I did all that kind of stuff, and then they had a funny little episode of a dinner party. Oh, yeah, I need to mention, if the book does not make you laugh, in the back of the book are recipes. And my publisher said, when we were finished the book, she said, Shelley, you need to put some Southern recipes in your book. And I said, but I hate cooking.
I was curious why you put the recipes in there when you said you hate cooking. It's like, what was that about?
Well, when I married this perfect man, my mother said to me, if you don't cook his supper every night, you're going to hell. So that was quite an impetus. And so I cared about him, and I cared so much about what he was doing, training as a pediatric neurosurgeon. You know, I took that all seriously. So I learned to cook, and I'm pretty good at it now. At least I can rustle grub and sling hash. That's what I call it. So the first recipe in there, of course, I can't ever color between the lines. I'm always having to come up something a little loopy or nuts. So the first recipe in the back of the book is pork chops for exhausted neurosurgical residents.
And then you have how to cook hot dogs.
Oh, yeah. For fun, I said, Julia, what was her name?
Julia Child.
Art of French cooking. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Julia Child gave me this recipe because I think she'd think it was funny. She had a great sense of humor.
Oh, she did. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And utterly deadly sweet potato pie. Homeroom mother's eggs. Yeah. one of the things that you also talk about in the book is the fact that you had polio as a child.
Right.
And I did want to ask what your thoughts are on this current climate where people are.
Right.
You know.
Well, that's why it's another reason it's important to read this book, because I'm old. I've lived a lot of history. And what I found is that if you live a long time, you suddenly become interesting. So I've lived a lot of history. In 1950, there was a polio epidemic, and my year, 33,000 children got the virus. And as soon as I was diagnosed, I was rushed to an isolation hospital in Memphis, where I spent 3 months contagious the first 2 weeks. And then as you lost your, the polio virus was through with you, and you couldn't catch it from me, we moved a ward up a time. They moved upstairs. But the point is, it was not the feature of my life, and that's why I kind of put it near the end of the book. It's interesting, and I have a lot of chutzpah and dealt with that at the age of 6. But 2 children died near me because they couldn't breathe. They were being put in iron lungs. And so when that happened, even though I was the age of 6, I had this sudden realization, I'm being saved for something. And my mother, when she told the story later, she said, oh, I prayed all night that you wouldn't die, and on and on. I stopped her. I said, don't tell me what you promised God. I was afraid she would promise that I would cure cancer or ingrown toenails or become the first female pope, which would be difficult because we weren't Catholic. So anyway, I stopped her from knowing what I was being promised for. But I realize now that I've lived my life, I do have a little survivor's guilt, which is good. Because I wanted to put something good and lasting in the world and reach out for other people through writing stories that would encourage them. In fact, I say in the book, and I'm really big on this, we need to all ask ourselves, what are we being saved for? Because life is so short. You're being saved every day to be here. And then another big part of what I want to get across through writing about that experience near the end of the book. When I was a teenager, I had a fair amount of surgery to get the use out of what muscles I did not lose. And I almost became addicted to morphine. And so I had a moment in my life where I said, you know, I could let someone else fix my hair and buy my cookies. I could just float on out. I don't need to do anything in life. This feels so good to float above the earth. It's a form of being dead, really, if you're that drugged by a strong drug like that. And so I decided I didn't want to live my life that way. And so I want all people to get across the idea that pain and hardship are here to be enjoyed, in a sense, because the alternative is to check out. And life is so short. Oh, it's short. So you have to enjoy every minute of it. Like T.R. Roosevelt said, take a bite out of it and let it dribble down your chin.
Well, Shelley, there's a couple things I want to talk about in the last few minutes that we have. One is, how did you get on NPR and, you know, how did that impact you?
Well, I decided after I've written two or three novels that I would become a better writer if I could tell a story in 3 minutes. So here at the University of Florida, I went down and talked to the manager of the radio station and said, would you give me a chance to see if I could be a commentator and say something meaningful in 3 minutes? And he said they knew who I was because I'd become kind of well known from the reviews of my novel and having a movie produced from one of them. And so he said, sure. And so I started, and it grew, and people in our community loved what I did, because I always promised myself I would be the butt of the joke and I would have something enriching or encouraging for them, at least in a slice of life. So I took some experience of my everyday life and made a little story out of it and made it fun. You know, when you have a story, it has a life of its own, and you start to fill in parts that, you know, you could call them a whopper, but part of being a good storyteller is knowing where to stretch it and where to leave it alone. Mm. And so I went for that. And then one day, NPR in Washington, D.C. called and said, we hear you're pretty funny. Would you like to tell some of your commentaries nationally? And so I did. And it was a wonderful experience, and it made me a much better writer. Yeah. If you can tell a story in 3 minutes, you're on to something.
Absolutely. Now, the other thing, you know, I'm looking through the list of books on your webpage, which is shelleymickle.com, and Shelley is S-H-E-L-L-E-Y, mickle.com. And the, you know, you've got your novels, but, and you mentioned you wrote a book about Alice Roosevelt. You wrote a book about the first successful organ transplant. You wrote a book about a horse. How do you, first of all, are those, like your nonfiction books, are they also humorous? And how do you decide what to write about?
Well, I can't not write. I want to do it. And, when some racehorses became famous, I told my agent, get me that job or you're mud. So I just about drove her crazy. And so within 48 hours, I was on a plane to go meet the horse and the owners. And because it was Simon & Schuster, an imprint for children, it was the first children's books I ever wrote. But to me, it was glorious because I see horse racing as a metaphor for life. And so to be able to write about Barbaro, the book, the horse that broke his leg in the second part of the Triple Crown, and then most recently, American Pharoah, who won the Triple Crown, and I flew up to meet him, and that was, I was in heaven.
Oh.
I wouldn't trade that experience for anything. So I'm like a cocaine addict. When I see a horse, my brain lights up.
And you've also, you did write a book about polio and the development of the Salk vaccine.
Yeah, and I pulled some of it out of it to put in this because I really want people to understand more about the process of viruses, because I've had several people ask me, believe it or not, if I'm still contagious.
Oh, wow.
You know, they don't understand the life cycle of a virus, and they're around us all the time. And then the biggest, craziest thing I did when I decided I didn't, you know, to write a novel, you have to be cool today. And if I was ever cool, it's rubbed off. So I thought, well, a couple of years ago, I'll try my hand at nonfiction. And it worked out great because I'd already mastered the art of what I call narrative drive, having a story that makes you turn every page. And you do that in a novel.
Right.
So I was able to lift these facts from history and put them together, a factual story. And I was so nervous about being accused of not sticking to the facts that they're highly documented. But anyway, when I asked my husband, did he have any suggestions of a story or history I might write about, he had trained under Joe Murray at Harvard, the man who performed the 5.5-hour surgery of the first successful kidney transplant. And he said, well, that story about Joe and the kidney would make a good book.
Wow.
So what was really funny about this is I made a C in college zoology. And yet I wrote a book about the discovery of how the immune system works.
And did you incorporate humor into it at all? I mean, that seems like it would be a tough one to make it funny.
Yeah. But the surgeons themselves are humorous.
Ah, yes.
And
yeah.
So they did that work for me. Like Joe Murray didn't have hair as he was older. And he said, my head is too busy to grow like grass on a busy street. It doesn't grow.
Well, Shelley,
I
want to thank you for being with us today. We're out of time, and we always end with a quote, and I'm going to pull the quote from your book from Norman Cousins.
Oh, good.
20 seconds of laughter is the equivalent in exercise of 3 minutes of strenuous rowing. So I guess I've gotten my exercise for the day.
Thank you, dear. It's been a delight. It was a hoot.
Well, thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.